God's ways are not our ways. This well-known idea comes to us from the Bible in Isaiah 55, verse 8. And it's this particular truth that comes home with power as we look at the portion before us in Esther 2, verse 12 to 19. Now, I don't know this by first-hand experience, but I am told that it is true, that nearly every young girl has a dream to be a princess at some point in her life, or a queen, as she daydreams about her future. Esther is living the dream, or is she? We see a young girl, a rags-to-riches story, becoming a queen, but we see it fraught with sinfulness, and it's fairly anticlimactic. Every good rescue story needs a virtuous hero, and Esther is sometimes noble, and at other times her virtue is ambiguous. Every good story about liberation singles out that hard-working, virtuous example that we should be emulating for success. Esther gets ahead by God's providential working rather than any greatness in her. So today, as we look at this rags-to-riches story, the story of an orphan girl who becomes a queen, well, we're looking at what, to our minds, looks like the usual recipe for success. You know how the story goes. You've seen the story arc in programs like America's Got Talent. The presenters spin that sad story where a poor and disadvantaged person, through their own determination and hard work, rises above their problems to succeed and conquer the world and take the prize. Isn't that the story arc that we're often told, and we get all the warm and fuzzies? This is not the story of Esther. God's ways are not our ways. God, not Esther, is the hero of the book of Esther, where we are programmed to see in her the great hero that we all need. The details of the text are, in fact, more realistic in terms of presenting an imperfect woman being used by a perfect God. Her actions are questionable, but God's outcomes are not. Her motives are mixed, God's promises are sure. Her performance is irregular, God's presence is a constant. We need to know that we are weak, but he is strong. When we are faithless, he remains faithful, and that he is able to bring his perfect will to pass through imperfect vessels, drawing straight lines with crooked sticks. God's ways are not our ways. And this is one of the lessons we learn in the book of Esther. Now, so far, we have met the king. We have seen him, on a whim, get rid of his disobedient queen, Vashti. We have seen him moping and trying to assuage the consequences of his actions by essentially stealing 400 of the empire's most beautiful women in search of a replacement queen. We've met Mordecai and we've met Esther. These are Jews who have been living in Persia for what seems to be too long and are too well integrated into their environment. And our narrative here in 2 verse 12 now picks up with the year leading up to Esther being chosen as queen. If you want, you can visualize it in terms of America's Got Talent. That behind-the-scenes backstory as each contestant is going through all their preparations to see who will win on the night. Our text looks at three aspects of this rags-to-riches story of Esther becoming queen. These will be our 3 points: a queen's beauty, a queen's favor, and a queen's marriage. And perhaps with these points, you'll be expecting a Cinderella-style romantic ascent. But our story, once again, is filled with the realities of fallenness, yet the faithfulness of God. So let's look at a queen's beauty. God, we know, made female beauty as a good thing. It is a gift that reflects God's own glory. And it is a blessing that she gives to her husband. But as with all of God's gifts, sin comes in and hijacks it, and these gifts become terrible burdens. Our text is a case in point. Men covet beauty. They want to own it, They want to control it. They want to define their own sense of importance by it. And so they go out in conquest, seeking to own beautiful woman. Esther was part of a beauty harvesting situation, where these girls were taken from their homes and their families and would be resigned to a life of satisfying one man, the life of a concubine. Our text begins with these women having to bear the burden of the then beauty industry. The beauty industry is often burdensome to women, no less so in the ancient world, and all for the sake of satisfying a selfish man. Look at verse 12 and 13. Now when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus after being 12 months under the regulations for women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women, when young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In 2017, dark-skinned woman spent $432 million on whitening products. $432 million out of the world's 10 billion economy of that year was spent on lightening products for a woman's skin. And that number increases by 17% each year. Women are often found to be slaves to the beauty industry. These young girls had to spend a whole year in beauty treatments for one night to impress the king on one night. Many a young girl has dreamed of becoming a queen, but we can see here that this would be no fun at all. The king, however, spared no expense to have these women present themselves to him at their best. Our verses focus on one of the more expensive treatments, the perfume treatments. Archaeologists have recovered perfume burners that women used to treat themselves in this fashion. Various oils would be put in this burner, and so a woman would wear a large type of gown, and she would stand over the burner, and the smoke would fumigate her hair and her skin and her clothing as she would try and beautify herself with the smell of these perfumes. 6 months spent using some of the most expensive oils, myrrh, in this treatment. Other spices and ointments. You can imagine the hours in the bath with all sorts of oils, and archaeologists have uncovered rose and musk as some of the other fragrances that would have been used. On top of these arduous beauty treatments, each woman was also given whatever she wanted to impress the king for that one night audition. You know, imagine it. You've got one night to compete with the 400 most beautiful women in the world, hoping he will remember your name. And so you're allowed to do whatever you want. What are you going to do? Perhaps she will set a menu for the meal for that evening. She will choose the entertainers for that evening. Maybe she'll do a poetry reading or have a philosophy debate ready to go. Perhaps she'll learn how to juggle. She'd have to choose her wardrobe. She'd be allowed to take whatever jewelry she wanted in with her. And some commentators suggest that these items would in fact be a type of dowry that she'd keep with her for the rest of her life and would be her possessions, her only possessions in the harem. She would be denied nothing in order to please the king. Seems generous, but isn't generous at all. Our text goes on to describe what happens the day after. Look at verse 14. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem in custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. So she went from the house of virgins to the house of the concubines. One night to impress the king. One night, this terrible burden of having to excel above the very best in the land, hoping that maybe, just maybe, you would be good enough. Imagine we had to try and enter God's presence in this way. If you were a concubine and you happened to fall pregnant and had a child, your child would not be an heir to the throne, but they would probably get a job in the royal courts. This was the lot of the concubines. So let's just stop here for a moment and let's compare once again Ahasuerus to Christ. Both are kings. Both are in search of a queen bride. Both will make a rags-to-riches story where a woman, not from royal stock, will be made a royal bride. But the similarities are skin deep. Ahasuerus consumes all to gratify his loneliness and lust. But Christ, on the other hand, gives all. Ahasuerus seeks and takes beauty, using it up selfishly. Christ surrounds himself with the ugly, the sinful, not the beautiful, and he gives us the beauty of his own righteousness, taking our own ugly sinfulness upon himself, becoming a stench to the Father. Ahasuerus uses up people's lives, using them up and casting them off if they do not satisfy, but Christ treats us differently. He comes at great cost to himself. He gives life and life in abundance. John 10, verse 10 and 11 says, "The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep." Where Ahasuerus will use a woman once, and if she does not please him, turn her away, never to associate with her again. Christ rejects none who come to him. He takes in the outcasts, the sinners, the rejects, and he makes them all his bride. Ahasuerus may not remember the name, but Christ knows the name of every single one of his sheep. Sadly, the picture of being enslaved in golden handcuffs, forced to undergo beautification treatments in order to satisfy a narcissist, only not to be good enough, to be used up and tossed out, and to be forgotten. Unfortunately, this is often a metaphor for our lives. But there is Christ. Ahasuerus, the richest, the most powerful man in the world, is nothing compared to Christ, who calls all to come to him and to find life. But then we need to consider the queen's favor. Our text moves from the general situation of all the women to the specific situation of Esther herself. Immediately it becomes clear, God is with her. Now remember, the name of God is never used in the book. How do we know God is with her? Because of the favor that she receives. God's blessing rests upon her. Doors are opening before her. She has favor. Read with me verses 15 to 17. "When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the woman, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebet, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight, more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." Now Esther, we know and we have noted, is a mixed bag along with all of us. We're all sinners, and so is Mordecai. These Jews have not necessarily commended themselves in the way in which Daniel and his friends have done, and we've noted that difference. In fact, they seem to have been fearful and faithless. But they're not all bad, and we do see some virtuous signs. As with all of us, we're not utterly depraved. In verse 11, Mordecai shows a wonderful family type of concern for Esther, being outside the harem every day, wanting to inquire, how's she doing? Is she okay? Is she getting on? Is she coping? And here we also see Esther, and just picture it for a moment. She's the most beautiful woman in the room, but she is wise. She listens to advice. She is humble. She's not just resting on her own gifts and expecting doors to fly open before her. She's showing some good character in being wise and humble. And of course, these are things to be commended. But what we want to talk about is the fact that she gained favor. Doors opened for her. In fact, three times in this section we see that she won favor. Verse 9, verse 15, and again in verse 17. Now, this word favor should be popping to your ears, because this is a word that comes up regularly, especially amongst the exiles. This is not a favor that is earned because of her righteousness. Imagine things only go well for you when you perform perfectly. Is it only then that we know we have the Lord's favor? When we know we've got everything right? And if things aren't going right in your life, why is that so? Because you blew it somewhere along the line. Is that the lesson we're supposed to be taking from Esther? No. Esther, we've already noted, is mixed. But God is gracious. And the favor that she has is a gift of God as he works out his purposes in order to preserve his people. Just think of it. Remember Joseph? Sold into slavery, thrown into prison, and yet Joseph gained favor. Genesis 39, verse 20 and 21. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. The Lord was with him, and God gave him favor with the prison warden. What did God use Joseph to do? To save Israel, as well as many in Egypt. God gave Daniel favor in Daniel 1 verse 9. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. Nehemiah and Ezra, they were granted favor and were released to go and rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. So here is Esther. She's given favor. Why? Because she's so amazing, or because God is so amazing? It's because of God's grace. God has given her favor. This is important for us because, friends, yours and my life, they are filled with unearned blessings. Now, you and I are often put into situations where God has opened doors before us, where we may have gained influence and favor. Should we think to ourselves, like maybe Esther could have done, but we know she didn't? Oh, look at how beautiful I am. How awesome and how righteous I am. God owes me these things because I am so awesome. Is that what went through her mind? Is that what should go through our minds whenever we are blessed? Of course not. Rather, we should see how God is working in hidden ways in Esther. And we should recognize that God often puts us into positions to be a blessing for others. Joseph was granted favor. Why? To be a blessing. Ezra and Nehemiah, favor for blessing. Esther, favor for blessing. Friends, you are blessed. You have been given favors. Why does God grant us favor? Yes, part of it is because he loves us and he seeks for us to enjoy these things to his glory. Don't get us wrong, that is true. But we are also all part of his greater plan. We have to think of our opportunities as a stewardship, thinking about how we can use any advancement or blessing to be a blessing for others. Esther could not see this yet, but we can. We can see why she is being given favor. We can see why she is receiving blessing. And it helps us to interpret the blessings in our lives. We are seeing doors swing open in her life by God's hidden hand, setting her up so that she could use it to bless others. So here's the question for you. What opportunities do you have in your life that you should be thinking of in terms of how can I use this to bless others? And let's consider the queen's marriage, verse 17 and 18. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. She is crowned as his royal bride. Now, many a young girl dreams of her wedding day. What dress will I wear? Will you wear? Not me. What will the man of her dreams look like? What will the look in his eyes be as he says his vows? Will he be crying? Will he declare his passionate love for her? The happiness of that moment spent with family and friends. And here is Esther. One of the most expensive weddings of the day, with thousands of guests, with one of the biggest and most expensive wedding feasts ever, which even changed political taxes and all sorts of situations. This wedding was so significant. But there's a shadow over this event, isn't there? There's a shadow over this grand, royal wedding. How much can a narcissistic king who is willing to bed 400 virgins really love anyone else? Esther receives the crown that Vashti refused to wear, but there are still all the other concubines in the picture. Esther may be a favorite concubine, but at the end of the day, that's all that she is. And what woman wants to be loved in this way? It seems that Ahasuerus may have some real affection for her. And she, Esther, may even come to have some real affection for him. It's possible. We aren't given all the fine details of the romance or the possible romance. But you see that language of grace and favor in verse 17? That language is not given to help you complete the love story and the romance arc. We always want to tie it off and say they lived happily ever after. That language of grace and favor does not exist to signal to you, and they really loved each other. That's not what it's meaning. That's not what it's, you know, that's where our romantic brains go, but that's not the purpose of that language. It's rather to show that God has opened a door for the future preservation of his people. You and I are consumed with romance and personal satisfaction. Esther's story is not told to satisfy these questions that we might have about whether they lived happily ever after or whether he truly loved her and really valued her above all the other women. These might be some of the questions that occur to you. The happily ever after of the book of Esther is not that these two people found true love, which they probably did not, but that God's people are preserved. We need to be reminded of this because we forget that the bigger purpose of our own existence is as part of God's plan, not to make our own personal dreams come true. The other big shadow that hangs over this event is the matter of being unequally yoked together in marriage to an unbeliever. We have noted how Esther and Mordecai have not taken the necessary stands, and now we see this Jew marrying an unbeliever. More than that, she's not a wife, she's a concubine, which is a legally binding union with less benefits. She has less of the rights of marriage. In the Old Testament, God's will of intermarriage was clear. Regarding entering the promised land, Israel was given a warning not to intermarry with the idolatrous tribes that lived in the land. Deuteronomy 7, verse 3 and 4. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you and he would destroy you quickly. It's the danger of idolatry. The matter here, let's be very clear, is not interracial marriage. God is not for Jews only marrying Jews because he's a racist. That's not the issue. The issue is religion. The issue is faith, not race. Ruth, we know, was a Moabitess, but she was a believing Moabitess, and she became part of the bloodline of Christ. The issue is faith. Now, of import to us is that in Esther's day, we know that Nehemiah and Ezra had gone back to the promised land to help rebuild the city wall and the temple. Remember Ezra and Nehemiah? I don't know if you know how the book of Ezra ends. A very disturbing picture. Ezra had recently purged the Israelites of all of their foreign wives and children. In Ezra 9, verse 2 and 3, we see his reaction to the news that these newly returned Jews, why had the Jews been kicked out of the promised land? Because of idolatry. Okay, and now they come back to the promised land, and what's one of the first things they do? They intermarry with the Samaritans and other groups that have moved into the land while Israel was out of the land. All these other religions are now present, and the priests as well as the Jews are now intermarrying with these idolaters. And Ezra comes and he starts pulling his hair out in grief as he mourns the sin, because this is the exact sin which had caused the exile in the first place. And he starts tearing his hair out, literally, because of the sins of the people. It says in Ezra 9 verse 2 and 3, "For they have taken some of their daughters to be wives for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy race has mixed itself with the peoples of the lands. And in this faithlessness, the hand of the officials and chief men has been foremost. As soon as I heard this, I tore my garment and my cloak and pulled hair from my head and beard and sat appalled." Just give that a try. In your anger and your grief, you just begin to rip it out. Because the sin was so serious. This led to national repentance and the act of putting away these wives and the children of these unions through divorce. And you can see that in Ezra 10, verse 11 and 12. All these wives that had been married, divorced. All the children from those marriages, put away. And then there's Esther. Marrying, intermarrying with a pagan. This is not a good thing, though the Lord will bring good out of it. We cannot lose sight of this. So when we come to the New Testament, we see continuities and discontinuities, don't we? It is still the case that Christians are only to marry in the Lord. 1 Corinthians 7 verse 39. If you are a believer, you are only to marry another believer. But in the instance where someone finds themselves in a situation where they are now already married to an unbeliever, or maybe one of you gets saved, Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 12 and 14, unlike Ezra, you don't have to divorce your wife and put away your children. So there's been a change, because there's been a change in covenant and a change in rules in the New Testament. Now, this is always a matter worth addressing in our day. We live in an age where Christians are an increasing minority. We live in a context where marriage is being sought less and less by many. And as a result of this, there are more Christians today that are unmarried than most generations in the past. This is one of the casualties of the era that we're living in. Some Christians have been given the gift of celibacy, but many are providentially hindered who would long to be married, and as a result, are single. Unfortunately, in desperation, many young people sin and settle for that bad match and marry an unbeliever. This is sin, and it will also lead often to unhappiness. Many have rejected the biblical teaching on this point, and they've entertained the devil's "did God really say" sort of argument and questions. They want to equivocate and as a result open the door to this sin. I want to share with you the words of one pastor's wife. The pastor has gone on to be with the Lord, and the pastor's wife, at the end of her long ministry, has been involved in many counseling sessions, and she's seen many instances where Christians have settled and sinned and become unequally yoked together in marriage. She has met many who now live with wounds and regrets. In the words of one woman who was married to a perfectly nice man who did not share her faith, she says, "If you think that you are lonely before you get married, it's nothing compared to how lonely you can be after you are married. Because you can't share the most important things in your life with what is supposed to be the most important person apart from God in your life." She talks about three possible types of marriage that will result from a compromise in this way. Scenario number one. In order to be more in sync with your spouse, the Christian will have to push Christ to the margins of his or her life. This may involve actually repudiating the faith, but in matters such as your devotional life, hospitality to believers, which includes small group meetings, emergency hosting of people in need, supporting missionaries, tithing, raising children in the faith, having fellowship with other believers. Those things will have to be minimized or avoided in order to preserve peace in the home. Or, scenario number two, alternatively, if the believer in the marriage holds to a robust Christian life and practice, the non-believing partner will have to be marginalized. If he or she can't understand the point of Bible study and prayer or missions trips or hospitality, then he or she can't or won't participate along with the believing spouse in those activities. The deep unity and oneness of marriage cannot flourish when one partner cannot fully participate in the other person's most important commitments. Or scenario number three. So either the marriage experiences stress and breaks up, or it experiences stress and stays together, achieving some kind of truce that involves one spouse or the other capitulating in some areas, but which leaves both parties feeling lonely and unhappy. There is no win-win in these situations. Now, let's be clear. In the case of Esther, although she did sin, let's be very clear about that. God is sovereign over our sins, does not approve of them. And the fact that he works things together for good does not sanction them. And nor should we presume that he will do this in our own situations. He turned it for good because he had a purpose to save his people who are being threatened with genocide in the near future. God does not promise good outcomes in the same way for your sinful mistakes. You can't read the book of Esther and go, oh, is that what happens if I marry an unbeliever? God causes good stuff to happen. Well, there's nothing lost. I'm just going to go do it. Hold your horses. Do not test God. Do not presume upon the Lord in that fashion. Because sometimes the good that comes to us, which the Lord will bring, comes in the form of the holiness and the desperation and the prayerfulness that we learn through the difficulties that we've caused with our own hands. Not necessarily a happy marriage. Just because God turned this situation around for good is not permission for you to go and sin and expect a happy outcome. God does not approve of our sin, though he may turn it for better things. And in the end, do you think Esther was happily married? Do you think she lived as a satisfying wife, having God's best in her marriage relationship? Does anyone here think that? It's obviously not true. But of course, Esther's marriage to Ahasuerus points us forward to our own marriage to Christ. Where Ahasuerus tried to beautify and purify his bride from the outside with perfume and money, Christ beautifies and purifies us with his own righteousness and with his indwelling spirit. Esther's beauty will fade. And maybe the king will stop loving her when she's no longer as pretty as she once was. Christ's love for us will never end. And our beauty will never fade. Ahasuerus crowns Esther, but how long do you think she held that crown? Was she a Vashti who'd be replaced as soon as she misbehaved? Christ crowns us and makes us a royal priesthood forever. Esther wins the heart of a narcissist because he's so shallow, but Christ loves us with an everlasting love. Ahasuerus throws a feast and gives gifts because of his find in Esther, but this feast leaves a sour taste in your mouth because, after all, he's stolen 400 of your daughters to decide which one he liked. He's going to keep them all for his harem, and hey, here's a party for you all. Does it feel good if you're one of the parents of those families at this feast? It leaves a bad taste in your mouth, doesn't it? But Christ will throw the wedding feast of the Lamb when he brings us into his new creation. The marriage supper of the Lamb is the greatest of all wedding feasts, where the guests who were once God's enemies are now adopted, who are now friends, who are invited into the closest of possible and unbroken fellowship with God, to be with him forever, enjoying all of his riches, all made ours through covenant, as Christ has become our bridegroom. Ahasuerus sought a beautiful bride and spared no expense in making her more ready to satisfy him. Christ sought a sinful bride that rejected his love, yet he spared no expense to save us, to make us his own, that we might find our greatest joy in him. God's ways are not our ways. God subverts our selfish dreams, but magnifies his grace through the salvation that he has wrought in Christ. More than that, where sin seems so strong and able to be a fly in the ointment, God is yet still able to use imperfect servants to bring about his good purposes. Friends, as you read the book of Esther, I hope you find it to be hopeful. Because she's not perfect. And you're not perfect. But God can cause his purposes to prosper in your life. Let's pray.